Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. The guilty verdict against a Syrian intelligence official adjudged to have been behind torture and killings of detainees during the country's ongoing civil war has been widely welcomed by the UN's human rights system. High Commissioner Michelle Bachelet hailed the historic conviction of the 58-year-old defendant, identified only as Anwar R., by a German court in Koblenz on Thursday. He was convicted of crimes against humanity for killings, serious deprivation of liberty, rape, sexual assault and hostage taking. No matter where you are or how senior you may be, if you perpetrate torture or other serious human rights violations, you will be held accountable sooner or later at home or abroad, the UN rights chief said, describing the development as a landmark leap forward in the pursuit of truth, justice and reparations for violations perpetrated in Syria over more than a decade. After a six-week surge, Africa's fourth pandemic wave that's been mainly driven by the Omicron variant is flattening, the World Health Organization, WHO, said on Thursday. The WHO said that this marked the shortest surge since the pandemic began on the continent, where total cases have exceeded 10.2 million. Recorded cases of infection show that the weekly number plateaued in the 7 days leading up to the 9th of January from the previous week. Southern Africa saw a huge increase in infections during the Omicron wave, but recorded a 14% decline in confirmed cases over the past week. And South Africa, where Omicron was first reported, saw a 9% fall in weekly infections. East and Central African regions also experienced falling numbers of cases, but North and West Africa are seeing a rise, with North Africa reporting a 121% increase this past week compared with the previous 7 days. Head of the UN Health Agency, Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, has spoken out over continuing blockades on life-saving humanitarian access to Ethiopia's Tigray region. Tedros said that despite the best efforts of the World Health Organization, WHO, it has been prevented from sending medicine for basic life-saving procedures.
We're deeply concerned from WHO side. We have tried all our best, but we're blocked from sending medicines to Tigray, Ethiopia. And that's so dreadful and unimaginable during this time, 21st century, when a government is denying its own people for more than a year food and medicine and the rest to survive.
It is now more than 14 months since conflict erupted between Ethiopian federal forces and those loyal to the Tigrayan People's Liberation Front. Tigray has been under siege for more than a year, Tedros told journalists from Geneva, before noting that WHO teams have been allowed to send medicines to Afar and Amhara regions. Daniel Johnson, UN News.
In the second hour following Law and Disorder,
how do we stop ourselves sleepwalking into another Great Depression? It's breathtaking, you know, for folks that are listening to this. I don't know if they realise the extent of the tax injustice issue, that you've got these major corporations and rich people that go offshore with the money. People get away with it.
World leaders meet and they discuss the big issues, inequality, climate crisis, but the whole thing is a charade.
I think prison should be very real for accounting professionals who advise on aggressive tax avoidance schemes, without a doubt.
What we know about how the mainstream media reported on the financial crisis is that the deeper structural problems with the banking sector weren't really covered.
The majority of the public now understand that there is an emergency. People need to know that there's something that can be done.
There is a new dawn which is happening. The resistance is coming from the old guard.
This opens up a crucial debate about how humankind wants to develop over the course of the coming century.
Join me, Naomi Fowler, and John Christensen for the TaxCast from the Tax Justice Network. We talk about how we take back control from the super rich and powerful and make our economies work for all of us. You can find us on most podcast apps and your favourite radio station can broadcast us for free. Get more information on us on www.taxjustice.net/TaxCast. See you there.
Again, that will be following Law and Disorder in the second hour. Enjoy. I hope you're having a fantastic Thursday. The workday is almost over.
This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we look at the various right-wing organizations, efforts at the state level, and big money to whittle away at what is left of American democracy.
We have with us as our guest David Armiak, who is the research director for the Center for Media Democracy in Madison, Wisconsin.
With distinguished constitutional litigator Martin Garbus on the direction in which the Supreme Court is going.
As Martin Garbus will explain, the Supreme Court is not headed in a direction that would support democracy. In fact, it is going in the other direction. Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
I am attorney Marjorie Cohn, professor emerita at Thomas Jefferson School of Law and regular columnist for truthout.org.
And I'm Jim Lafferty, a decades-long political activist and once the national director of the National Lawyers Guild.
We are at a pivotal moment in this country, and the coming year may well decide whether we can right the course of history. Professor Nancy MacLean's important book, Democracy in Chains, revealed the right's decades-long stealth campaign to reverse-engineer America back to the days when the robber barons reigned supreme and rigged the legal and constitutional rules to work in their favor. She wrote that Trump and the forces of the right are actively trying to rig the conducting and counting of elections, state by state, as they create a frightening, autocratic, post-truth society few would have ever thought possible in America. The January 6th insurrection was a dress rehearsal for a Trump coup attempt in 2024. If he loses the election, Trump and his far-right supporters are laying the groundwork in state legislatures to take control of the electoral process to reverse the loss and claim a victory. The alliances between the corporate state, Trump, and white nationalists have seen a flood of dark money to subvert free and fair elections, block climate and economic justice legislation, push for a constitutional convention to permanently guarantee the rule of the rich, and the crippling of the federal government's ability to protect working families, the environment, and promote equity for all. The investigative journalism published by the Center for Media and Democracy has exposed groups on the far right like the American Legislative Exchange Council, ALEC, or the Heritage Action, or the Republican Attorneys General Association, RAGA, which are working hard to suppress the vote, tear down the firewall to protect our democracy in 2022, and put Trump acolytes in positions of power where they can subvert future elections. We speak today with David Armiak, who's a research director with the Center for Media Democracy. He has conducted extensive investigations on dark money, corporate corruption, and right-wing networks, and is responsible for filing and analyzing hundreds of public records requests every year. David Armiak, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
David, please talk about the special interests that have deformed American politics and poisoned the American polity.
Oh, geez, where to start? You know, we could talk about big polluters or big tobacco, big pharma, defense contractors. You know, it's hard to answer in a short amount of time, but you know, it's really corporate America and how they built up this massive lobbying infrastructure and, dark money and campaign vehicles in order to, sway both politicians and the American public to deregulate our economy and protect, their corporate profits, which are quite dear to them.
It's pretty clear to all that the right wing for decades now has been using a stealth campaign, if you will, to reverse, really, engineer America back to the days when the robber barons reigned without any interference to speak of. I wonder if you could tell us a bit about that and what the impact of that has been on where we're at now in America.
Yeah, sure. So, there's a number of different facets. One place to start is the disastrous Citizens United ruling, mm-hmm. which unleashed a flood of campaign financing and unlimited amounts of money, to our political system. what that has done is it has allowed, you know, those with more money, you know, the extremely wealthy individuals, you know, like, you know, Charles Koch, for example, the CEO of Koch Industries, and other billionaires and millionaires, to have greater access and greater sway, you know, over our politicians, to deregulate our economy, to, you know, create tax codes which, you know, benefit them and increase their profits, to build, you know, a steady base of politicians that are receptive when they are in need of something, you know, whether it be at the state level, the city level, county level, or national level.
David Armiak from the Center for Media Democracy, tell our audience what dark money is, please.
Yes, sure. So dark money is money that is untraceable to, you know, the individual. To give you an example, right, you know, campaigns will accept donations and in their filings list those individual donations there, right? But now we have things like super PACs, for example, where folks can, you know, use it as a sort of pass-through, so to say, where, you know, they can give the money to that PAC or that, you know, political action committee, and then that political action committee will give money to a candidate or candidates. You know, a good example of this, you know, speaking of Charles Koch earlier, is Charles Koch's Americans for Prosperity Action. So billionaires or millionaires or other donors will give money there, and then that, you know, PAC will distribute the money. So we don't know exactly, you know, where that money is coming from for a particular candidate. We know that it's coming through a committee, but we don't know, you know, who that individual, you know, actually gave that money. There's other examples in the nonprofit sector. So there's a large number of groups that are seeking to influence our judiciary system, and there are nonprofits set up. And in this case, we don't even know, because they're not required to disclose on federal filings, you know, who is giving money to these nonprofits. But these nonprofits then in turn do issue campaigns, place ads to try to get their judges seated, you know, whether it be at the Supreme Court level or other levels of government.
David, you mentioned Charles Koch and the Koch brothers we've heard about. With respect to Charles Koch, though, just how rich is he, and what are some of the more pernicious, from our point of view, in terms of what you're talking about with our threat to democracy and such, does he have, and what has he been up to over the last several decades, and what has been the impact of that, do you think?
Yeah, it's a great question. So Charles Koch is the you know, owner and CEO of Koch Industries. He's worth $54 billion. In the past, people referred to, you know, their operation or their political operation as the Koch brothers' operation, because it was him and his brother David who were running it. But David, you know, passed away some years ago. They're libertarian in terms of philosophy, so small government is something that they're, you know, very interested in, you know, no or little, as little regulations as possible. In terms of connections, he has lots of them. And as of late, he has sought to rebrand himself as someone who is, you know, not of a certain party, or someone who, you know, seeks to raise the wealth of wealthy, you know, leaving the others behind, but as someone who cares, you know, deeply about, you know, all Americans. But in fact, that has really, you know, not been the case. Organizations that he, you know, has funded and politicians that he has funded have really done a lot of damage to our country. You know, you take the insurrection, for example, many of those who voted to not certify the election results received significant amounts of money of Koch cash over the years, of Koch network backing, from organizations like his AstroTurf Army, Americans for Prosperity, or they were members of the American Legislative Exchange Council, a state-based, you know, national organization that brings together state lawmakers together with corporate lobbyists to write model legislation or push policies into the state that are of great interest to corporations. He's also been, you know, very involved in the remaking of our federal and state and local judiciary to get, you know, corporate-friendly judges placed and rewrite how cases are held or cases are decided. So really, he's been incredibly influential over the years. And I haven't even gotten into, you know, the work that he's done, you know, to try to sway university campuses across the country and move them to the right. He sees a lot of them as, you know, socialists or communists, centers of thought, and has, you know, worked, you know, quite in a sophisticated way to fund libertarian centers or centers that push things like deregulation, from funding of students to actual funding of professorships to providing resources to house all of them in campuses across the country and other places of the world as well.
David, ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, has done stuff regarding voter suppression and gerrymandering, and I wonder whether you could talk about that, please.
Yes, yes. So, you know, I'm glad you asked that question. The Center for Media and Democracy has, you know, been keeping very close tabs on ALEC for over 10 years now, based on a large number of whistleblower documents, including hundreds of model bills that we received just over 10 years ago. And we house them on our blog, alecexposed.org. But they started around 10 years ago, you know, pushing model legislation around voting in elections, most prominently the voter ID law, you know, which is a form of voter suppression. There's nothing in the U.S. Constitution that says you need an ID to vote, but they successfully placed this in many state locales, which has been an obstacle for folks to vote. But more recently, yeah, just last year, that they were working with the Dark Money Project called the Honest Elections Project, which is associated with Trump's drudge whisperer, Leonard Leo, man responsible for moving our judiciary to the right during the Trump administration, but to circulate different types of voter suppression bills and push for policies which that'll make it harder for people to vote in future years. And they've met before for 2.5 days before their summer meeting 2021, and then just in December we found out that in their so-called States and Nation Policy Summit that they held another 2-day meeting to, you know, with national leaders on the right, many of which, I should say, are affiliated with Trump and his network that's developed since he's left office.
I'm curious about the Republican Attorney General Association. I assume, as the name suggests, it consists of some or all of the, you know, attorney generals of the Republican Party across the country. RAGA is its four-letter short name. More importantly, what have they been doing, and what do we suspect they were doing or know that they've been doing with regard to the January 6th insurrection?
Yeah, so this is another organization that the Center for Media and Democracy has been tracking very closely. And yes, you're right to assume, you know, that RAGA, or the Republican Attorney General Association, is made up of Republican attorney generals, although some have sought to distance themselves since it became clear that they were involved, you know, with the January 6th insurrection. Evidence of that includes that, you know, Attorney General from the state of Texas, Ken Paxton, spoke at the rally preceding the march, which resulted in the insurrection. The 501c4 nonprofit affiliated with RAGA, called the Rule of Law Defense Fund, sent out a robocall calling on people to march on the Capitol on January 6th. But they also, we know, you know, in looking through open records requests, that they held meetings to strategize with about what to do, you know, following the election. And many of them were involved in, you know, different challenges, you know, following the election of Biden between, you know, that election and January 6th. But in general, RAGA is a pay-to-pay group. They, you know, bring in corporations. Right. And depending on what level you pay at, you get different types of access to attorney generals at their meetings, which they hold at least 4 times a year, although it now appears that they hold many more than that. And they work on all different types of policy. They work together to coordinate amicus briefs, it appears, you know, which are, you know, sort of supporting documents for court cases. So it's a very powerful organization. And, you know, after Trump lost his election and Biden was elected, they called themselves, you know, the first, you know, sort of front to protect, you know, Republican or, you know, right-wing interests, you know, after the Democrats in January won those Senate races down south and secured, you know, complete control of Congress and the White House.
David, I'd like to speak further with you about the flow of dark money and what it's doing to subvert free and fair elections. What do they do to rig the legal and constitutional rules in their favor? And please specifically discuss the obstacles they've set up to voting and to and the gerrymandering that's been accomplished.
And speaking about dark money, so one of the main groups that we've been able to identify, work on, as I mentioned before, is the Honest Elections Project. So this is actually not even a registered organization. It's a legal alias of the 85 Fund, which is a nonprofit associated with Leonard Leo's network. And, you know, things that they are doing, you know, are try to make it harder for people to vote absentee, to try to get rid of the voter ballot boxes that some of the cities and states, you know, set up during the pandemic, which allowed people to drop off their ballots safely, right, without having to interact with folks. But they're advocating for you know, purging of voter rolls, for example, expanded voter ID, so narrowing the definition of indefinite or confinement or, you know, disability, you know, which some people, you know, it's very hard to figure to navigate through the system. So it results in, you know, people giving up or not really being able to vote because they're not aware until it's too late, right? So, yeah, I mean, this is the type of stuff that you know, the right with dark money are working on to make it more difficult for folks to vote.
David, we've heard more in recent years about the Federalist Society. What is the Federalist Society? And its head is Leonard Leo. Why do they call him the quote-unquote judge whisperer? What connections, in essence, does all of this have with far-right groups and with what they're trying to do to influence courts, judgeships, and the like?
Yeah, another great question. You know, it's an organization that's incredibly powerful, the Federalist Society, and one that not many people are aware of. They have chapters in just about every state or every state. It's been a while since I double-checked that. They meet, you know, in different locales. They have connections with university faculty and law schools. They have centers within law schools for conservative or right-wing law students so that they can, you know, sort of get a pipeline into particular jobs. So they do a lot of, you know, sort of networking and also so-called education, right, to push different types of legal theories. A lot of it, you know, is based on, you know, so-called originalism thought. So in his head, right, as he mentions, Leonard Leo, and they call him the Judge Whisperer because he was tasked when Trump was elected back in 2016 to develop a list of potential Supreme Court justices in case he needed to fill any openings, which of course he did. He had to fill three over the course of his, you know, 4 years in office. But he also advised him, you know, on filling, you know, hundreds of federal positions across the country in the federal judiciary, which has resulted in the packing or capturing of courts. You know, if you're able to get the courts, right, the judges, then you'll be able, you know, their thinking is that they'll be able to get the decisions that they want, you know, when they bring those courts up. The scary thing is in many cases, you know, they chose very, very young judges, and they place these judges in lifetime, you know, appointments. You know, the effects of this, you know, are really going to be long term, and it's hard to determine, you know, exactly what that means, you know, for our future. But certainly, it's going to be good things for corporations as they bring, you know, cases to the courts to have corporate friendly judges there. In terms of connections, you mentioned what kind of connections does he have? You know, does Federalist Society have with other far-right groups? Many. I mean, I'd already spoken about Honest Elections Project. He's gotten into voting. He has some judicial activism groups. You know, Judicial Crisis Network is one of them that works to help get judges seated and to present a positive, you know, light of judges. And many of these, I should say, are, you know, Federalist Society members. So it's all, you know, very, very much so interconnected.
David, how do all these forces plan to lock in power permanently?
Well, there's a couple ways. So, you know, I didn't answer your gerrymandering question, but that's one. so, you know, if they are able to successfully gerrymander or redistrict so that they, you know, on the right are able to maintain control of state houses and bring more you know, Republicans to, you know, the U.S. House and the U.S. in particular, then, you know, they will have, you know, more influence. And, you know, a place like Wisconsin where I am, you know, that's become very clear. You know, they challenged the maps that were drawn by the legislature here, and, you know, the judges, you know, the governor refused to sign them. So it went to the state Supreme Court, which has been packed with, you know, right-wing judges. Those judges have said, you know, we're basically going to do minimal changes from the map 10 years ago. So they're going to get another 10 years of, you know, a gerrymander, you know, which is really unfortunate for people in the state. But the other way that they plan to lock in power permanently is through a constitutional convention, or what is known as the Article V process. So they're hoping to force a state-led constitutional convention to radically rewrite our constitution, which would, you know, they could do all types of things once they're there, because there really aren't a lot of rules or parameters for this type of convention. It's never been held since the first one was held to write our original constitution. So they could, you know, do away with all types of regulations. They could do away with federal agencies or departments, like, you know, getting rid of the Department of Education. They could, you know, allow states to ignore Supreme Court rulings. They could put in restrictions around voting. They could do really whatever once they get there. If we look at the makeup of state legislatures across the country, you know, the vast majority of them are, you know, Republican-led and dominated. So you can only imagine, you know, the types of things that they might want to do if they're able to, you know, start from scratch and rewrite our nation's founding document.
Well, David Armiak, I guess the ultimate question, that, or at least for the moment, is what does all this portend for the outcome of the 2024 presidential election? I mean, we have any number of respected historians and political analysts wondering if this isn't going to mark the end of what little is left of American democracy. What is your thought on that?
Yeah, I mean, we're totally worried about, you know, the outcome and what might happen, you know, in 2024, especially after watching what unfolded, you know, the last time around. You know, there's a lot of disinformation around that is, you know, floating around. The networks to push out that disinformation are, you know, expanding and are more well-funded and more sophisticated. You know, so it's very scary to think about what possibly, you know, might happen. But with the voter suppression bills that are passing in state houses across the country, it's really going to benefit Republicans, or it seems like it will benefit Republicans in the long run. And as long as we have the Electoral College system, you know, they can, you know, likely find a way, you know, on the right to push their candidate forward, whether that's Trump or the governor down in Florida, DeSantis, whoever, you know, on the right that they really want. Yeah, I don't know if it will mark the end of American democracy. I really try to think more optimistically, but I'm definitely worried and concerned, and a lot of people are, and that's why we continue, you know, to fight to expose their efforts and to provide, you know, information on, you know, what the right is up to, you know, around voter suppression and elections and voting, you know, so that it can be, you know, exposed, and hopefully policymakers that are in a position of power right now, you know, will do the right thing and, you know, pass laws to prevent this from happening in the states.
We've been talking with David Armiak from the Center for Media Democracy in Madison, Wisconsin. David, before we have to say goodbye, can you tell our listeners how they can follow your work?
Yes, sure. Happy to. So we publish on our blog, exposedbycmd.org, but you can also follow us on Twitter at exposedbycmd. We also maintain a couple wikis that feature a lot of our research. I spoke at length about the American Legislative Exchange Council, so you can go to alecexposed.org to find everything and anything about ALEC, including your state politicians that are members, most recent model bills that have been introduced and passed by the organization, and, you know, corporations and other organizations that are members.
Before our show today, we learned that in the Congress now, coming from Mitch McConnell, coming from other Republicans, coming from Manchin, there's talk of tweaking a bit the 1887 Electoral Count Act that you made some reference to, the electoral vote, And many on the other side of the aisle, the Democratic part of the aisle, of course, see that as a trap, and that's a road we shouldn't go down. I wonder what your thought is on that or any other last point you'd like to make.
My sense of all that is with Manchin and McConnell and the Republicans, you know, opposing taking up any kind of voting suffrage, is just a delay. They're just hoping to keep delaying, and that it, once the 2022 midterms come, they're hoping to retake the House, possibly the Senate. They'll be able to prevent it. So that's why I think they just keep flipping back and forth and suggesting different things. It's just a matter of, you know, just trying to keep delaying to prevent any type of action at the federal level. I will also say that if it's related to the Electoral College, I am kind of concerned, because there is another effort, right, that you may be aware of called the National Popular Vote Compact. And quite a few states have already passed. And what they're trying to do is that if, you know, all the states in the compact, you know, reach a certain number of Electoral College votes, that they'll all agree to vote for the candidate or push their Electoral College delegates to the candidate that wins the popular vote in all those states that are part of the compact. So this is kind of a way to get around the issue of candidates losing the popular vote but winning, right? You know, as what we saw, you know, for example, in 2016 with Trump, he won the election but lost the popular vote by 3 million. So perhaps they're trying to work on this. We know for a fact that the right wing is taking this very seriously. They have a campaign called Save Our States that is, you know, specifically, you know, dedicated to work on this issue and is well funded to try to preserve the Electoral College and defeat this effort to determine, you know, presidential election by popular vote.
Thank you for that, David. Really.
Yeah, thank you, David. You know, we've come to an end, unfortunately, to our allotted time. So Jim and I are going to have to say goodbye, but we're very grateful for your being on Law and Disorder, and we wish you and the Center for Media Democracy all the best in the coming year.
Yeah, appreciate it. Yeah, Happy New Year to you both, and wish you a good year.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
The Supreme Court, as presently constituted, has 6 reactionary judges and 3 liberal-minded ones. Progressive people are alarmed by its recent decisions and fearful of what it might do in the future. One of the liberals on the court, Stephen Breyer, is 83 years old. Should he retire, it would give the Democrats the opportunity to try to appoint a replacement who is not a reactionary. This will be an uphill battle, but it's a fight well worth it. A right-winger will certainly get the job if a Republican president and Republican-controlled Senate in the year 2024 choose a successor to Breyer if he dies or retires. When Barack Obama was president, he hinted to the liberal Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who was 80 years old and a two-time cancer patient, to step down, but she declined. Ginsburg died while still serving as a justice of the Supreme Court. Republicans in the Senate would not allow a vote for Judge Merrick Garland, whom Obama had nominated for the Supreme Court seat. Ginsburg was then replaced by the young right-wing Brett Kavanaugh, who joined two other young right-wing Trump judges. The Trump-dominated Republican Party is well aware that to topple democracy, they must take over the courts. The current Roberts Court has, for more than a decade, consistently leveled this attack on democracy by eviscerating the Voting Rights Act, unleashing unlimited corporate monies into elections, allowing clearly partisan gerrymandering of elections, and is now training its sights against reproductive choice by severely restricting abortion rights. Yale historian Jason Stanley has recently written, "There is every reason to believe that the court will allow even the simplest of democracy to crumble as long as laws are passed by gerrymandered Republican state houses that make anti-democratic practices, including stealing elections, legal." We speak today with returning guest attorney Martin Garbus. He's a constitutional litigator who has represented Stephen Donziger, Nelson Mandela, Daniel Ellsberg, and Lenny Bruce.
Welcome to Law and Disorder, Martin.
Thank you. It's a great, great pleasure to be talking to you.
What did you think of Ruth Bader Ginsburg's decision not to retire when Obama could have replaced her on the Supreme Court?
I think it was awful when Thurgood Marshall refused to step down. Thurgood Marshall, of course, leads to Clarence Thomas. Ruth Ginsburg, of course, leads to Amy Coney Barrett. And now with Breyer, we're going through the same thing again, except now there is an ostensible majority, a Democratic majority, in the Senate. And although the Republicans' new game plan to delay, delay, delay will cause a war, and there can be a fight and we can lose it, I think it's the time to make that fight now. But if you have a Republican in 2024, you will have a United States Supreme Court at 7-2 for decades.
Marty, what was the role that Ruth Bader Ginsburg played on the Supreme Court, and why was it important?
I think she was very important. I think she stood as a role model for men and women. I think that she bought her politics, which is close to ours or mine, and I think she was relentless. I think, on the other hand, she also was a woman, as we all have our vanities, who did not step down, even after bouts of cancer. She didn't approach it all as clean, let's say, as Breyer is. She hung on far, far too long. And if you look at the important Supreme Court cases of the last years, Citizens United, Shelby, and then its sequela to Goldberg against Kelly, you see the reinforcement of the end of a democracy. And we're now in a political time when we recognize the stakes are very, very different when it was Ruth Ginsburg and Thurgood Marshall time to step down. You now have the possibility of what people call a democracy. We know, of course, it never has been that, but of actually causing this government structure to end. So we're at a critical time. Breyer has served 27 years. Ruth Ginsburg served 28. Kennedy, who stepped down when he was asked to do so by Trump, so he could then appoint a Kavanaugh type, has acted totally differently than the Democrats. And I think what has happened over the years is the Democrats have just failed at this whole question of fighting over the court. And one of the reasons, I think, is because people like Breyer insist that judges on the United States Supreme Court are not voting out of political ideology. But as he puts it, he says when you see differences on the court, it's a different interpretation of the law. I don't think anybody believes that. Michael, Marge, we've all spent time in the political area. We've all spent time in the courts. We all know very dear friends. I was trying voting rights cases in the early 60s in the South. And to think that politics did not determine the cases is delusional.
Martin, why was Ruth Bader Ginsburg's role on the Supreme Court so significant?
Well, she was an important voice for a liberal set of views. She did not delude herself and think that court decisions were made by the law itself. She understood that decisions were made for political reasons. So, first of all, she saw the law differently than someone like Breyer. She had fought the great fight, as it was seen that she had fought the great fight and a great commitment to women's rights. Of course, her commitment went far wider than that. But she got cancer. She had two cancer surgeries, and she refused to step down. Had the Democrats, both Obama and Biden, had a chance to appoint younger judges, younger Democrats, who wouldn't be sitting on the court now, and might outlive some of the conservatives, you would have a totally different world. You look at three cases in the United States, it's really just, you can see what's going on. Or even two, the voting rights case, Shelby against Holder, and then you can look at Citizens United. And those two cases have basically decimated our democracy. And whatever reason she had then for not stepping down, there was a certain political atmosphere then, but the political atmosphere today is far, far different. We all recognize that we're now at a point where this very government form may not function. People now, I admit, this country of freedom for each person, et cetera, never existed. We all know about, of course, slavery and how the country existed in 1800. We also know now that the government structure of how you appoint electors and how you vote in elections has been totally destroyed by the Republicans, so that they can easily, in power, take away more and more rights. So at the time of Ginsburg and then Thurgood Marshall before her, who refused to step down, we did not have a situation where this country was so much at stake. And just a few more decisions, like Shelby, like Citizens United, like the sequela to Goldberg against Kelly, and this undemocratic country becomes more undemocratic and flows towards some other kind of political institution.
Marty, could you explain to our listeners what Shelby versus Holder was all about and why it was so significant, and do the same with the Citizens United decision as well, please?
In the 2020 election, you saw a dramatic change in voting habits. You saw 43% of American voters voting by mail. You saw 26% of the Americans voting early, a dramatic change in the voting process, and that supported, basically, that allowed minority groups to come to the polls. And it dramatically changed the amounts of Democrats, so that in the last couple of years, you have seen the Democrats win with respect to the sheer numbers in the election, and then you see them lose because of the setup of the Electoral College. So what you're dealing with is the infirmity, in a way, of the Constitution, which, although it says each man is equal, etc., you don't have equal rights. We know that, of course, throughout the United States, throughout the 1800s, 1900s, you never had equality at the polls. And then in 1965, there was passed the Voting Rights Act, which attempted to protect minority groups so that they could vote. And then the Republicans saw that if you close down certain things, voting, if you close down voting polls near black communities, and if you close down the opportunity of people to get to the polls, you could dramatically change the election results. So what happens is, having changed the election results, you then get Republican minorities changing the structure of the government. And that's going to continue between the infirmities in the Constitution and the striking down of the Voting Rights Act of 1965. There has been a total attack on the voting system. Citizens United dealt with the ability of wealthy people to pour endless money into campaigns. So both of those cases deal with the takeover of the voting system. The third case that I was involved in, and it's called Goldberg against Kelly. That case is decided in 1970, before Brennan steps down, before Berger comes in. It's the end of the Warren Court. And in that case, I represented the plaintiffs. We were trying to create a groundwork for something like a minimum income. It dealt with equality. Brennan said, 5-4 decision, Brennan wrote it, said it was the most important due process case of the century, because he understood how you could take that case, and on that, you could build and build and build and deal with the economic disparities in the United States. Well, a year after Goldberg is decided, as I said, Brennan is down, the Warren Court's over, and since then, all you've seen with the Republican Court is a total attack on that decision and any case that attempts to deal with income inequality. Brennan was very optimistic that Goldberg, which he basically put together, the discussion that goes on in the United States Supreme Court when Brennan is trying to persuade a majority to go with him, is historic and marvelous, and it took an enormous amount of work, and it was a great, great victory. And since 1970, the United States Supreme Court, under Republican leadership, has cut away and eviscerated that case. Adam Cohn, a very fine New York Times reporter, wrote a book called Supreme Inequality, dealing with that case. I wrote a book called Courting Disaster, dealing with voting, money, and Goldberg against Kelly. And I think that we were all, unfortunately, prescient in seeing exactly what would happen. But none of us ever visualized that we would be where we are today. And January 6th, I don't know how you all felt about January 6th. There was a part of me that was glad to see it, because I understood that was there, and that unless it was exposed and unless it was ripped open, it would just continue quietly as the powers that led to Trump and supported his ideology would be built up. So I think that January 6th is very much a result of the frustration, and that frustration tells us that if in the years to come Trump or people who feel like him are elected, whether it be Abbott or DeSantis, that you will see the Constitution basically discarded. That this is a critical time. It's unlike when Thurgood Marshall did not step down. It's unlike when Ruth Ginsburg did not step down. You could say that she was right in not stepping down, but that would still not make Breyer right in not stepping down now. And what's amazing is that the Democrats, basically, since 1980, have not dealt with the question of the legal system in the same way that the Republicans have. The Republicans formed the Federalist Society in 1980. I, others, would write about what was happening, try to encourage a Democratic response. We all failed. The Republicans had the battlefield, except for a woman, except for Nan Arryn in Washington, who was focused on the courts. Very, very few Democrats were, which is astonishing. And the fact that Breyer doesn't step down now is a continuation of that failure. So it's really been, you can see, 40 years or more of Democratic failure when someone like Breyer says that judges do not make political decisions, when Breyer says the decisions are all based legal differences, it's delusional. There was a wonderful constitutional philosopher, Ronald Dworkin, and he used to say the same thing. And then he and I talked at the time of Bush against Gore, and he totally changed his position. How someone like Breyer today, after Citizens United, Bush against Gore, the Voting Rights Act case, can continue to say the same thing is just, it's preposterous. Very few people on the Supreme Court will say what he says with a sense that it's really true. They may say it politically, but certainly Ruth did not, Ginsburg did not say that. Ruth Ginsburg had every obligation to step down, certainly over cancer. Thurgood Marshall could not function on the court physically. And the question is why, and Breyer should get out. The question as to why these people do not step down, is it vanity? They have a commitment and this is what they have done? Those are hard things to answer. Clearly, Ruth Ginsburg enjoyed being the notorious RBG. But the precedent she sets for other Democrats who say, well, she didn't step down, I won't step down, is wrong, and it's killing the country.
Marty Garbus, in 2019, the Supreme Court refused to put guardrails on partisan gerrymandering. Then, before the 2020 elections, during the pandemic, the court refused to extend Wisconsin's deadline for submitting absentee ballots. And last summer, the reactionary justices greenlit voter suppression in the Brnovich decision. Justice Sotomayor said she doesn't, quote, see how it's possible that the court will be viewed as a nonpartisan and fair after the reactionary justices rolled back abortion rights. Therefore, do you think new seats should be added to the Supreme Court? Do you think the justices should be term limited? And if so, how to do it?
I don't think it can be done. It's a very good question because people are talking about it. New seats, limits, I don't think you can get anywhere with it. It's an issue that many Democrats would oppose, and certainly the Republicans would oppose it. So yes, it's being talked about, but I don't think the conversation has any meaning.
And are you talking there, Marty, about adding new seats to the Supreme Court or term limits?
I think both. I think there's no chance of either.
Whether there's a chance or not, do you think it should be attempted?
I think it's such, to me, it is such an obvious loser that I don't. I think what should be attempted is Democrats becoming as political and as responsible as someone like Arthur Kennedy, who steps down so that a Kavanaugh type can be appointed. I think what should happen is the Ruth Ginsburgs, the Thurgood Marshalls, the Democratic nominee should realize what the court is about. Jeffrey Rosen, a very respected scholar, talked about the Supreme Court or the court system as being the only place that is nonpartisan. Years ago, he wrote a book about how it's the only place where democracy really exists. And it's clear now that nonsense at the time, but there's no way of believing that's not nonsense now.
Marty, how does the number of federal judges that Biden has nominated compare to the number that Trump nominated and the number that Obama nominated?
Well, there have been a great deal of nominations. I don't know the details of the circuit court and the district court nominations, but in the circuit courts, they are so dominated, by and large, with very few exceptions, by the Republicans. I mean, the Ninth Circuit, when all of us grew up, was a great liberal court, and the government has done everything they can to weaken that court by even when cases from the Ninth Circuit come up to the United States Supreme Court, the Supreme Court treats the Ninth Circuit as a Democratic court and has very little reluctance to reject their cases, while at the same time, cases that come up from the Fifth Circuit, which is a Republican court, are nearly uniformly followed in the United States Supreme Court. So I think that there has to be a ground roots awareness of all this. The Republicans have had it certainly since 1980. The Democrats never had it and don't have it. How could Ruth Ginsburg justify, after two cancer operations, before she finally gets off, her staying on the court? Trump would have had her off in a minute, but Trump is the yardstick for the opposition at this moment. So to say that you're going to be nobler than thou, as Breyer says, and says it's not politics that decide cases, is just naive. I don't know how you can have an intelligent discussion or a real battle for the Supreme Court when the Republicans get away with asking people to step down. Years ago, Arthur Goldberg stepped down. That was a kind of a different situation. But he talked about vanity as a factor. And I think that has to be there. One thing about Arthur Kennedy, people recognized that he came from a certain elite economic strata, and his concerns were to make his strata far better. Breyer and Ginsburg also come from a very, very different economic strata than Sotomayor. They have had a life of privilege. Sotomayor's voice is speaking up for those who did not have a life of privilege and want to see, get some of the benefits of the money that's there.
Marty Garbus, unfortunately, we've run out of our allotted time. It's been wonderful having you on Law and Disorder. Thank you very much for your insights, and we hope you'll come back on the show. You have a good new year.
Thank you.
Take it easy.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. That's lawanddisorder.org. One word, lawanddisorder.org.
Soñar divina la ilusión que me trajiste para sentirte tuya, tuya tú como ninguna. Pues desde que te fuiste yo no he tenido luz de luna. Pues desde que te fuiste yo no he tenido luz de luna. Yo siento tus amarras como garfios, como garras que se ahogan en la playa de la farsa y el dolor. Y siento tus amarras arrastrar en mi noche callada que sea plenilunada, azul como ninguna. Pues desde que te fuiste yo no he tenido luz de luna. Pues desde que te fuiste yo no he tenido luz de luna. Querida, que está triste y está sola, al menos tu recuerdo ponga luz sobre mi bruma. Pues desde que te fuiste yo no he tenido luz de luna. Pues desde que te fuiste yo no he tenido luz de luna.
Somebody call for me. Said the bankers all are leaving. You better come round and see. It's starting revelation. They robbed the nation blind. They're all down at the station. No banker left behind. No banker, no banker, no banker could I find. They were all down at the station. No banker left behind. The White House, they went one day. They was going to call on the president in a quiet and a sociable way. And the afternoon was sunny, and the weather, it was fine. They counted out our money, and no banker was left behind. No banker, no banker, no banker could I find. They were all down at the White House. No banker was left behind. Conductor's calling all aboard, we'll be leaving soon. With champagne and shrimp cocktails, and that's not all you find. There's a $1 billion bonus and no banker left behind. No banker, no banker, no banker could I find. When the train pulled out next morning, no banker was left behind. No banker, no banker, no banker could I find. When the train pulled out next morning,
if you enjoy public radio and the national public radio news programming here in Kansas, I'm going to help you. We have a statewide network of national public radio news stations, and I'm going to give you a list and the call letters and the numbers, the frequency numbers that they're at. Now, I'll be reading them off slowly and giving the names, so you have plenty of time. But I suggest you get your pencils ready. So if you're driving across the state of Kansas and it's a long drive going east to west, you might consider having this list handy, because you can digitally reprogram your car radio and be in tune all the way across the 400 some odd miles of the great state of Kansas. So if you have your pencils ready, let's go. Here are some of the blowtorch. Of course, the Kansas Public Radio Network hub is Lawrence, Kansas at 91.5 FM. And if you have a high digital radio, it's also 91.5 KANU. Now, this broadcast is reaches as part of the network Emporia, I believe Atchison, Olsburg, and I think Junction City. And then there's a separate network reaching down to Wichita. Here is the Kansas Public Radio Network out of Lawrence, Kansas, the frequency numbers and the station call letters. Junction City is 91.3 FM, a KANV. Also, it's the same frequency, HD, for Olsburg. Again, that's 91.3 KANV, Olsburg and Junction City. Emporia is KANH 89.7 FM and also 89.7 HD. That's Emporia, KANH. Atchison, Kansas is 89.9 FM. Chanute, Kansas is 90.3 FM, KANQ. Salina is 89.5 FM, KHCD. And Manhattan is 99.5 FM and 97.9 FM. Wichita, Kansas has KMUW at 89.1 FM. And they broadcast BBC World News from midnight to 5 a.m. every night, as well as the Lawrence Public Radio Station. Salina is 89.5 FM, KHCD. Pittsburgh is 89.9 FM, KRPS. Again, that's Pittsburgh, 89.9 FM, KRPS. Hutchinson, Kansas is 90.1 FM, KHCC FM. Hill City, Kansas is 90.5 FM, KZNA. Hayes, Western Kansas, is 91.7 FM, KZNA also. Great Bend, Kansas, and Garden City, Kansas, have two different frequency numbers, but both go by the call letters KHCT. Great Bend is 90.9 FM. Garden City is 91.1 FM. So there you have the list of the affiliates stations across the state of Kansas that broadcast your national public radio news every day. I hope this helped you in your travels across Kansas.
Would you like your group announcement, or maybe you're holding a demonstration and would like it read on Radio Free Kansas? There's no charge for this service, and it gets out to a large audience of listeners in Kansas who can think for themselves. You and your friends don't have a corporate logo or brand name, but maybe want to manufacture dissent and democracy instead of conformity. Radio Free Kansas is the place to have your news announced to a large community in the reddest of all states, Kansas. Or as we've been calling it lately, Brownbackistan. The disappointing news is you might not get your news on Radio Free Kansas. Sorry. If you were a cheerleader for the last two bankrupting wars in Iraq or Afghanistan, go elsewhere. Or how about a paranoid gun rubber trying to get your buds to go camping, sitting along some Kansas creek by a campfire, planning some racist New World Order, won't get the next gun show announced on Radio Free Kansas either. How about 24% of the conservative voters who go to church regularly and believe President Obama is the Antichrist or a space alien without a birth certificate? Well, you can try. You believe in angels, demons, and magical miracles, don't you? Send it in. You never know. Or maybe you believe you do? If you think Kansans, smart Kansans might be interested in coming to your event, go ahead and send it in. Feel free. It's free. Email to bluebarnnewscentral@gmail.com. That's bluebarnnewscentral@gmail.com. Please provide some contact information, such as an email address or a phone number. And thank you for listening to Radio Free Kansas.
Down on the farm we had a pig, J. Edgar was his name. We'd eat up all our victuals and start back up again. Just like the vacuum cleaners, they sail down in the lane. Well, that's how J. Edgar Hoover got his name. Now Mama baked a cherry pie and set it out to cool, so we'd have something good to eat when we got home from school. J. Edgar climbed up on the porch and ate up all that pie. When we got home that morning, we heard our mama cry. J. Edgar, J. Edgar, just look what you've done. You ate up the cherry pie that was for everyone. We made it through the dusters and the hoppers too. But God help us, J. Edgar, 'cause nothing's safe from you. Bobby wouldn't work a leg. He drank that moonshine liquor and it always made him sick. We rode church on Sunday and stayed a while in town. When we reached home at supper time, poor Bob could not be found. He wasn't in the parlor and he wasn't in the lane, drinking in the pantry or sleeping in the hay. His hat was in the pig pen that he always wore. Poor Bob won't be drinking moonshine liquor anymore. J. Edgar, J. Edgar, it just don't seem fair. You ate Bob the hired man while we were at prayer. Let's say a prayer for poor old Bob and our country too. Save from you.
Hello and welcome to the TaxCast, the Tax Justice Network podcast. We're all about fixing our economies so they work for all of us. I'm your host, Naomi Fowler. You can find us on most podcast apps. Make sure you never miss an episode by emailing me on naomi@taxjustice.net and I'll put you on the subscribers list. Okay, so for this edition, let me transport you to the island of Jersey, a British Crown dependency in the Channel Islands, close to the rocky coastline of France.
It is beautiful. It is. We moved there when I was a child. I was about 9 years old, and I just fell in love with Jersey. I thought it was the coolest place.
It is a beautiful place. It's also a tax haven, and it offers all sorts of financial secrecy. There's apparently £1 trillion sitting in this tiny island's trusts, companies, funds and foundations. It's a major artery into the city of London. Now picture St. John's Manor, a Jersey estate of 58 acres, a spectacular manor house with landscaped gardens, a lake, its own chapel and a Japanese water garden.
It's in many ways like a fairy tale. It's got ponds and geese and chapel and there's nothing like it. The air is better. You sleep better. Or I used to sleep better there. And I really loved it. I'd hope to grow old there.
This is Tanya Dickstock, the daughter of Canadian multimillionaire John Dick. He's been immersed for years in court cases involving trusts, transactions, banks and law firms across the world. Much of them concern the activities of a Jersey trust company called La Hougue, which was once headquartered at St. John's Manor.
For some reason, different newspapers, news sources are still saying that my father allegedly owns La Hougue, or I'm alleging he owns La Hougue. No, I'm not alleging anything. A court of law, not one, but two, have adjudicated John Dick owns La Hougue. It's not me saying it. It's a court of law.
Okay, that shows you the kind of power a very wealthy person can have, doesn't it? So your parents set up a trust for you. Can you tell me about that?
I guess you could kind of look at it as an inheritance. Actually, the trusts were set up as part of my parents' divorce settlement. And so a large part of the marital assets, instead of being divided between the two of them, they put them into trusts specifically for my brother and myself. There were three different trusts there, and one of them, by my 40th birthday, I was to receive half of the trust assets. And then my brother, upon him reaching the age of 40, would have gotten his half. And how much was in the trust, we've tracked hundreds and hundreds of millions of pounds. So I think there's at least half a billion. We're not done calculating yet. So.
And at some point, your father told you that the money in your trust was gone.
Yes. In 2010, he came to me one day and basically said, "Bad news, Tanya. The trusts are bust. All the money is gone. And I'm really sorry about that." And I'm thinking, whoa, hold on. There is no way that this money can be gone. I want to know what happened. When I did start digging into it, there was still about $100 million in assets still in the trust. They were still in the process of stealing the rest of it. What they'd done is put a bunch of fake debts on it. But at the end of the day, I was able to save about $100 million.
The they, she's accusing, are La Hougue trustees. Through his lawyer, a former trustee admitted in a U.S. court to fabricating documents. La Hougue and its current trustees deny fraud allegations put to it by journalists. You've probably noticed that Tanya didn't have your average childhood, being from the family that she was. And she says she's not motivated by revenge against her father.
It was very difficult for me to cut him out of my life, but it became, I had to remove that cancer, or it was literally going to kill me. It was frightening. It was initially sad, but it was really crazy how once I'd removed him from my life, completely cut him out, it was the first time I have felt at peace. I was safe.
The drama stopped.
Yes. You don't put yourself through what we have for money. And now it's about justice. And it's about everybody else. It goes beyond a movie. If you saw a movie, you wouldn't believe it.
Yeah, the Jersey's a mafia.
This is Darren Stock, Tanya's husband.
People on that island are scared to death of the authorities there. And who wants to live that way? You know, and you rapidly lose the gas to fight when it's just about the money. I've heard enough stories now that I actually have nightmares about what I've heard. Why we're doing these interviews is not for Tanya's sake. We're doing these interviews for the other people. We can be a voice. We can be an organizer. We can be the lightning rod to help bring change.
Since coming forward, I've been contacted by a lot of victims, people who don't have a voice. And they have encountered some of the same things that I did. I am by far not the only one who's been stolen from and defrauded.
This fight is not about a jilted daughter. It took us almost 3 years to come to the conclusion that we were going to go public. And then when Tanya and I made the decision to go public, we decided we couldn't go kind of public.
It's all or nothing.
Either you were going to do it all or you just don't do any. And then we decided that we had to put our name to it. So not only being a whistleblower, but actually attaching our name to it.
Speaking out publicly has meant laying out every aspect of their lives for journalists to check up on, including Darren's own dispute in the past over a tax bill in the States. But let's get back to Jersey. 10 years ago now, Tanya discovered a kind of Pandora's box of incriminating evidence. She found it in St. John's Manor, the incredible place where she grew up. And at the time, she was preparing for her wedding there.
In 2012, we were married on the 4th of July. And in the process of planning for the wedding, I was looking for a place that I could store all the boxes of tiki torches and flower urns and all the stuff that was coming in. And I needed a staging area. There was an old squash court and nobody used it. So I thought, well, that's perfect. It's close enough to the house, you know. So I got the master key out and I go running down there. I open the door. And much to my dismay, I'm looking around and there are just boxes and boxes and boxes. Did you see Raiders of the Lost Ark? And you know that last scene where they've got the Ark of the Covenant and it's been boxed up and they're wheeling it in to, you know, that warehouse with all the boxes, and the camera pans back and you just see more boxes and more boxes. And that's what it felt like, because they were piled as tall as I was. And my heart sank because I'm thinking, I need this space for my wedding, you know, and they're dusty and they're dirty and there's like dried leaves and spider webs and dead bugs. And I'm thinking, ugh, this is trash. I got to get rid of it. So my first thought is let's toss it. And then I'm looking at the labels on the side and I notice that there are trust names and some of them are my trust names.
There were 333 boxes in total and what turned out to be 350,000 documents. So you had the wedding. When did you and your husband, Darren, get down to going through all this stuff?
Well, by the time we got back from our honeymoon, we started looking through the boxes that had my trust name on them. You know, I guess this is fate. I end up with the one guy who not only is smart enough to see what's going on, but he's also got an honest streak in him that's about a mile wide.
And we were this close to throwing them out, you know, and she ends up keeping them. And then it just kind of turns into one of those aha moments.
Typically what the trustees would do is they would just look at me and go, well, you don't understand. That's another thing that I found. It is a very male dominant system of what they do in Jersey. They're very chauvinistic. And it was, don't bother your pretty little head. You just don't understand. Don't worry about it. Go ask your father. And then my father would go, well, no, you have to talk to that trustee. That trustee would say, no, it's that trustee. That trustee would say, oh, no, you have to talk to your father. I mean, you could never get a straight answer. And then what they would give me made no sense at all. So, you know, Darren is now in the picture and he's got a background as an investment banker. So I would go to him and I'd say, can you look at this? Am I crazy? And without having gone to law school, it would have been much harder for me to look at some of these documents and truly appreciate the implications of some of the documents I was seeing. I mean, some things you just know are wrong. Like I ran across a memo and they were talking about, you need to be careful when you're fabricating this document that you use old paper and old ink. So if they test it, they can't tell that it's a fake. And yeah, I think everybody pretty much understands that that's bad. But when you realize that they were creating shell companies and filling in fake debts, making assets disappear, and introducing it into court systems all over the world, bankruptcies in Canada, in the UK, in the US. So yeah, you have no idea how damaging this stuff is.
There's a treasure trove of evidence on some who used LaHougue's services. Tax cheats, a pawn king and convicted tax fraudster, Russian and British oligarchs. There are links to the famous missing Botticelli Madonna and Child painting from 1485 and the disappearance of more than $100 million from the US savings and loan crisis back in the 1980s. So presumably some heat started to be felt in Jersey.
Yeah, LaHougue tried to move from Jersey in 2007-2008. LaHougue changed his name to PanTrust and moved to Panama. PanTrust is the extension of LaHougue. So in 2015, as we're digging into the boxes deeper, and then we were like, well, maybe we should go to Panama, you know, and go down there. And everybody's like, Panama's so corrupt and you'll never get anything out of it. Well, we thought, well, I mean, why not take a shot, right? So I myself flew down to Panama to meet with the regulator. And I was expecting, you know, we'd gotten some legal counsel down there. And what they had prepped me for was basically that we were going to go in and make a formal complaint to some junior person. And then that was going to, you know, probably have a junior lawyer involved. And then it would take an hour or two, then we'd go on. I walk in to the meeting, and it was pretty obvious early on that something was afoot, because they actually took us up to the main floor of where the headquarters of the regulator is. Because in Panama, the trust world is regulated by the banking division. And so the head of regulation is actually a cabinet level position. So you're talking about an actual government agency that you're dealing with, you know, appointed by the president of Panama. I walk in to this boardroom that's got 40 people sitting at this table. I mean, the head of investigations, the head of police, the head of banking, the regulator himself is there. Their lawyers are there. And so we have triggered something. We walked into something and we don't know what it is. Now, at this stage, I still think John Dick is a good guy, right? Shortly after that meeting, the Panama regulator terminates PanTrust's trust license. The Panamanian regulator took the unprecedented step of issuing an unbelievably scathing letter of just the danger to society that this organization is. Panama, of all places where everybody said they would do nothing, is the only jurisdiction that actually did something, which is the shocking part. And you look back at Jersey and you're expecting them to actually be the ones that would be the upstanding white knight. And they want nothing to do with this. They're shutting it down at every juncture. And then they go on the offensive to attack Tanya.
We'll get back to Jersey shutting things down in a minute. Tanya and Darren worked with a group of experts to help them track what were very complicated transactions over decades.
Then when we started tracking the money, you know, follow the money, follow the money, follow the money. And one day we were sitting with our advisors. We were in this hotel boardroom and these great big whiteboards all over the place. And we're drawing out transactions, companies, the money. We've got all these lines going, and every time it's going to one box. And we sat back, and one of the people, I still remember it, my heart sinks even when I think about it now, and they went, oh my God, Tanya, it's your dad. And you know, this is like early 2017, late 2016, and it was just, I was absolutely sick, because I had been defending him. The trustees were saying, oh, it's your dad. Your dad's the one who told us to do this. We were just following orders. And he's saying, They're lying. They stole all the money. I'm so sorry. I should have never trusted them. And then I find out, no, it was him.
That's something Tanya's father, John Dick, continues to deny. He says he was a victim of fraud too. But Tanya remembers as a child going into her dad's office and getting told off for playing with a load of old typewriters, old ink, old sheets of paper, stamps, all sorts of stuff. Tanya, why would anyone keep all those documents in the squash court that you found? I mean, why wouldn't you get rid of it all?
Yeah, the only reason that makes any sense at all is that he kept this to blackmail Jersey. This was his get out of jail free card. If anything ever went wrong, I went to the police expecting them to investigate and to do something about it because I had clear cut fraud.
Yeah, you run across the fraud, right? Mm-hmm. You've got the documents and you take it to the police and you're expecting a certain reaction, right?
I was told that Jersey places an affirmative duty on its people that if you see suspicious activity, you are bound by law to go and report it. You don't have a choice. So, you know, talk about suspicious activity. There was evidence of money laundering, fraud, identity theft. So Darren and I, we went to the police and we filled out police reports. One of the detectives came to the squash court and he's looking around all of these boxes and he says, so all of these boxes are fraud. And we said, yes. And he goes, so it's not just like everyday records and, you know, a couple bad documents thrown in. We're like, well, you know, we haven't been through all the boxes, but no, I mean, it's pretty chock-a-block with fraud. And so he takes the cover off one of the boxes, he reaches in, he pulls out a random piece of paper, and it talks about shredding the documents, which is against the law. You have to keep the documents, you know, for trust companies. And it talks about shredding the documents, hiring commercial shredders, getting black bin bags, and then burning them at the tip. So he looked at that and he went, yep, okay, I take your point. And then the police seized the documents and the detective said it was one of the worst cases he'd seen where there was such a plethora of evidence. And it went from him being very excited about prosecuting it to him going, oh, by the way, I'm kind of retiring. So yeah, I think he got forced into retirement.
And it's when you start to engage with law enforcement and the courts in Jersey that the realities of the state captured by finance really start to show themselves.
Yeah.
And there's a culture in Jersey that they call the Jersey Way. You know, you don't stand up and speak out against the kind of insularity and conflicts of interest that you get in a small jurisdiction like this. It's one of the reasons so many small islands tend to become popular places for secretive finance sectors.
I never understood it until I found myself in front of two Jersey judges. They were both my father's former lawyers for 20-some years. The head of the police commission, he was also my father's former lawyer. I mean, the conflict of interest is astronomical. When we started going through the boxes, I found another document, too, that made it very clear the trustee of LaHoob, the guy who was doing the day-to-day stuff, there was a memo he sent to my father, and one of LaHoob's clients was very unhappy and had threatened to go to the Jersey regulator. There's a memo that I found that was in the boxes where he writes to my father and he says, well, one of our clients has threatened to go to the Jersey regulator. He's very unhappy right now. And I told him that he could basically pound sand and I'm not worried about it because we'll just immediately pay our way out of it as usual. I'm like, pay our way out of it as usual.
But I mean, you did take some steps. You must have suspected that the justice system in Jersey wasn't necessarily going to take action, right? Because you took quite a lot of steps to preserve that evidence, didn't you, before the police took it?
Well, actually, we were really lucky that we were able to copy a large chunk of it before we gave it to the police. But then the police allowed us access as well. So we went in and made further copies.
And they made copies.
And then the police copied a bunch of the boxes and gave us a digital copy of what they had copied. Yeah, I think we probably have about 80% of what was there.
And you've set about making much of that accessible to journalists through the Organized Crime and Corruption Reporting Project. And there are lots more conflicts of interest we haven't talked about. Incredibly, many of the 350,000 documents from the boxes were handed over by the police at some point to a Jersey law firm, which in 2015 was still representing Tanya's father. That was unearthed by journalist Leah McGrath Goodman of the Institutional Investor. Now, that law firm denies any relationship with LaHoug and says it currently has no relationship with John Dick. So I've been to Jersey. I mean, it looks good, doesn't it? I mean, you know, I've been to the court in Jersey. It has a nice coat of arms, oak panelling, you know, the little parliament building. It all looks good. But when I went to Jersey for the TaxCast in edition 88, I spoke with people like the co-founder of the only political party in Jersey. I mean, I know the whole system there is not, it's not really functional, is it?
It's like a movie set.
Yeah.
Because what you think you're looking at and what's really happening are two very different things.
Yeah. And why it's important for other people to pay attention to what's happening here, because this really affects everyone, the rule of law.
Yeah, there is a danger, a wider danger to everybody. So a lot of Tanya's money has disappeared into someone's accounts. There are ongoing legal processes. It's taken you both a lot of determination because a lot of people wouldn't have pursued things this far. And I've spoken to people who've lost their pensions, lost everything through scams that have used offshore secrecy and the impunity that can exist in those places. And it's been really devastating to them. But tax havens, secrecy jurisdictions also attract a lot of people doing unsavoury things, you know, hiding criminal proceeds, cheating on their taxes, that type of thing. And they're not going to go to the authorities when they get ripped off. So, you know, you have this really big culture of impunity left, right and centre. And there's often a kind of panic to protect the jurisdiction from any negative publicity, from any scandal, because they don't want to drive away the money.
Yeah. When we started pushing on this, we've run across some very horrific crimes. I mean, it's very black and white what had happened. And Jersey would not investigate it. And on the surface, I think people look at that and they go, Jersey's trying to protect its good reputation. And the reality of it is they're not. What they're really trying to do is protect their bad reputation. Because what they're trying to tell the underworld is come to us and nothing will ever be investigated. You can do whatever you want and nothing will be investigated. And that's the signal that they're sending to the underworld to bring the business there. Where I think the average guy walking down the street sees or hears this rumor that Jersey's not doing an investigation, and they're like, well, they don't want to tarnish their image. You're missing the point. It's quite different. You know, we've been contacted by people in Jersey that had their home stolen. And that's why Tanya was such a threat to them. Sitting with 350 boxes of some of the most incriminating evidence, and you know, the last thing they're going to do is do an investigation. And the first thing they're going to do is go on the offense against Tanya. And now that Tanya's gone public with it, of being a whistleblower on it, we've had a lot of people come forward with a lot of information. Now it's a matter of just going, what does it mean to us as a society? What it means is if you got enough money, you can literally buy the judiciary, you can buy the police, you can buy the whole ball of wax. And I don't think that's what the people of Jersey signed up for.
They've weaponized the court system against what they perceive as a threat. And I was a threat because I wanted justice.
So the system has been bastardized in a way. Now it works for the 2% and it punishes the other 98%. And what we want to be able to do is help Jersey spin it backwards where it helps the other 98% and it punishes the 2% that are doing the crimes.
Do you ever think about letting it go and walking away? I mean, what will be enough for you to say, now I'm at peace, I've got what I want, we've got what we wanted from all this fighting and all this trouble and pain?
That's a really good question, because that's actually something he and I have been talking about lately is, you know...
And it's not money. It's not the money.
What's the goal? You know, when do you take your spurs off and set your hat down and go, all right?
Yeah. We want to change the narrative. And what people need to understand is that when you bring that bad element onto your turf, it all comes with a cost. There's a yin to the yang. And it's like a cancer. If you don't deal with it, it will kill the host. You know, it's inevitable. They're not going to investigate anything, because any investigation is going to unearth what they don't want the world to see. And that's the tragedy. And at some point, you get to a point of no return. And that's where I think Jersey's gotten to. It'd be the last place you'd do business. We're talking to the people of Jersey and the people of Cyprus and the people of the United States and the people of England, because what's happening is the rot that's in Jersey, and I could give you example after example after example of where they've exported it all over the world and absolutely decimated your court, and you don't even know it. This is a much bigger picture, and it literally touches each and every person.
For me, it's about accountability. I want to see reform in Jersey. I want a spotlight on judges, on the police, on the entire justice system.
Yeah, people in Jersey should be very concerned. They should be listening to Tanya quite closely. But so should the people in England, and so should the people in Canada, and so should the people in the United States, because we've seen them literally terrorize the banking system in the United States, the judicial system in the United States, and in Canada, and in the UK, and in Russia, and in Cyprus. It runs everywhere.
It's now 10 years since Tanya and Darren discovered these 33 boxes of evidence in St. John's Manor in Jersey. In Panama, the authorities revoked LaHue's sister company's license so it could no longer operate from there. In the US, there have been important admissions in court and litigation is ongoing. In Jersey, there have been no criminal charges, prosecutions or regulatory penalties imposed by Jersey's authorities. But what Jersey courts have done is award some huge costs against Tanya Dickstock and block her from participating in its court proceedings. These Jersey rulings, with all their conflicts of interest involved, could prejudice or at least influence courts in other jurisdictions. Financial secrecy is really at the heart of it, and it really needs to go. And for that, laws must change, and financial regulators and tax authorities must be independent, well-funded, and empowered to enforce those laws. You've been listening to The Taxcast from the Tax Justice Network. My special thanks to investigative journalist Nikki Hager, and thanks to you for joining us. We'll be back next month.